Are we pretty much on time? Might as well get started. Cool. Okay, hey everybody. This is partly based on some stuff that some of you may have seen previously at an LCA with some updates applied. Now, a little while ago, I got myself one of these, and my wife thought I was buying a car, but I was actually setting out to get myself one of these. And people have this concept that modern cars, I mean, everybody understands that a modern car has a computer in it, but that's basically as far as it goes. You think, okay, it's got an ECU, like an electronic control unit or an engine control unit. And you know that when you take a car along to your mechanic to get it repaired, often they'll plug in a laptop and the laptop will give them some diagnostics and tell you what's going on. And then they use that information to make their repairs. But it's very much closed. It's a black box. You really don't understand what's going on with it. And the reality is that in a modern car, there are actually a lot more electronic subsystems than you may be aware of. Now, this is an RX-8 is actually a fairly old design. It's originated around 2002 sort of design era. The stuff is a lot more advanced than this now. But let's strip back the skin and have a look at what's going on inside here from an electronics point of view. Now, the primary ECU is called the PCM, which is the powertrain control module. That's the device that links into the throttle assembly and various other things and does a lot of the central coordination of what's happening within the car as it's driving along. And it's actually a fairly grunty machine. In the case of an RX-8, it's a 32-bit system. It's not like a tiny little microcontroller or anything. It's a fairly serious computer. There's also the anti-lock braking system, and there is the instrumentation cluster, which actually requires two CPUs just to display all the lights and stuff on the dash. There's also the keyless entry control module and the electronic power steering system, which is another whole computer subsystem. There is a dynamic stability control system, which we'll talk about in just a second. That's what helps make you a better driver through software, kind of. There are steering angle sensors. In the case of an RX-8, there are two steering angle sensors on the steering shaft. So as you turn the steering wheel, the computer knows how far you are turning the steering wheel, how much of pressure you're applying, and things like that. And it's got a couple on there for redundancy, because you don't want that kind of thing to fail while you're moving along. There's also a tire pressure monitoring system, so the engine, the vehicle management system is monitoring the pressure in the tires, and as it, the dynamic stability control system gets feedback on slew rates and G-forces and things like that, it can take all of that sort of thing into consideration as well as it adjusts what the car is doing. And if this was if my car was an auto, it would also have a transmission control module. It's a manual, so I don't have that. But auto cars have a computer just looking after the transmission as well. And so this is, as I said, a design from around the 2002 era, and it's been in production for a few years since then. But if you look at a more modern car, like if you go and buy a Ford that's rolling off a production line now, a simple base model will typically have about 40 major computer subsystems in it. And some of the more high-end models will have far more than that. So they're becoming more and more sophisticated all the time. And so the reality is that when you drive your car, this is actually what you are doing. You may think you're driving, but there is software sitting in between you and what's really happening. And I should point out that a whole lot of this stuff is now fly-by-wire. In the case of an RX-8, when you push down on the accelerator pedal, like in a traditional car, there is a linkage that goes through to the throttle. In an RX-8, it's just a pedal on an arm with a big spring. All you're doing is pushing against a spring. There is a position sensor, which is measuring how far down you're pushing. The computer reads that, and then the powertrain control module makes its own decisions about how much power it's actually going to apply. Even things like, as I said, steering has electronic intervention. The braking system has a little brain second-guessing you and doing what it wants to do, not necessarily what you want to do. So it might feel like you're in control of the car, but in fact there is a whole lot of stuff going on between what you do and what the car does that you may not even be aware of. This is really cool. This is dynamic stability control, one of the things it can do. This is just one of the examples. If you enter a corner, in this case, entering a corner too fast, and the car is tending to underrun the corner, because of slew sensors and various other things within the dynamic stability control system, the car can detect this and figure out that you actually need to turn the car a bit harder, and it will apply the brakes to the back right wheel to change, basically to apply a pivot point. and the center of mass of the car, because it's offset from that corner, will then tend to rotate around that pivot. So as you are entering a corner, if you're cornering hard in a car with dynamic stability control, it'll actually compensate and help get you around the corner faster than if you try to do it on your own. So that's where it kind of makes you a better driver. But you can't always rely on it. You can't always rely on it. Testing this stuff is really, really fun. This is a test rig for a company based, I think, in Germany, where they do testing of stability control systems for trucks. And you know, obviously, to test something like this, you have to take it beyond its limits. So as you can see, it's got big wheels on the side so that when they flip it right up on its edge and it hits the limit, they can do this stuff without actually flipping the truck over. But it doesn't make you invincible. And if you're stupid, you can still drive into places that the car can't get you out of. The way all of this works, if there are all of these different subsystems, one way to think about it is that a modern car is a bit like an office building. It's got internally, it's got a LAN. It has a whole lot of devices distributed around it, and they all need to coordinate. And so a modern car typically uses something like CAN bus, which is controller area network, which allows multiple devices to all be communicating with each other relatively quickly. And unlike an office network, which is based on TCP/IP and retransmission, where there is no hierarchy between devices, in something like a CAN network, or in CAN bus, devices have a hierarchy. And the reason for that is that there are going to be messages passing around on this bus from all sorts of devices, some of which you really, really care about, like the airbag deployment system, and some you don't care so much about, like whether to increase the volume on the radio. And you don't want those sorts of things colliding. So the system is smart enough to be able to prioritize messages and make sure that high-priority messages get through, even when low-priority ones don't. And so this is where you have to really start being careful if you're hacking around with a modern car. With old cars, they had lots of discrete systems, and basically there'd be a switch that would turn on a relay that would control a load. You could mess around with individual subsystems or devices and not really have much of an effect anywhere else. It's not so much the case with a modern car, so you have to be really, really careful. Now, this is a little example from an RX-8. Obviously, you can't see the detail there and don't really care about the detail. That's not the point. But this is a little part out of one of the pages of the 60-odd page interconnect diagram for an RX-8. So that's not the subsystems. That's just the interconnections between the subsystems. So we'll zoom in on a little bit down here. And that big box on the left is the display. So this is the display that's in the sound system. So it's showing you what station you're tuned to and things like that. The interesting thing is if we look at this little line here, there's a connection from the head unit to the anti-lock braking system. Interesting. So most people think, oh, I can mess around with the sound system in my car and it's not going to make any difference. These are the sorts of things you have to be very, very careful of. So I spent a lot of time hacking around with cars, and I really hope that some of you try this as well, but you just do need to be aware of this sort of stuff. Now, in this case, it's only informative. Basically, the display that's used for the radio is also used to display things like the traction control system has just kicked in, and so it's informational messages coming back. If you switch out the head unit, the traction control and the anti-lock braking system are still going to work, but you've still got to be careful of this sort of thing. And so the question then is, where to start? How do you start playing around with car electronics without killing yourself and everybody around you? And the easy way to do it with a modern car is using a thing called OBD2, which is onboard diagnostics. In 96, legislation was introduced in California which required all new cars to have an interface adapter on them called OBD2. And so pretty much since that time, well, manufacturers like to standardize their production lines, so if it comes in California, it comes in pretty much everywhere. And so most cars produced after 96 have an OBD2 interface on them. It's not quite as simple as that because OBD2 actually wraps a whole lot of incompatible standards and puts them all on one connector. So just the fact that your car has OBD2 is not enough information to know how to talk to it. But what it does give you is a single port that you can connect to and get information coming back from your engine management system. You can send queries to it. You can alter things within the car. And so that's probably the best place to try. And it means that you don't have to do any soldering and mucking around with cabling in the car itself. And it looks like this. The legislation says that it has to be within 3 feet of the driver and it must be accessible without using any tools. So typically it'll be just under the dash or behind the glove box or somewhere like that, like behind a little plastic cover. Pretty easy to get to. And what you can do is grab one of these devices. This is a, if you look on eBay, you'll see them with titles like that because they're trying to include every keyword possible. But basically what this does is take care of all of the electrical and the protocol level interface stuff on the OBD2 port and converts it to a nice little serial interface that you can talk to really easily. The USB connection on here enumerates itself as a serial device. So all you need to do is take a laptop computer, one of these little dongles, which you can get typically for, you know, $30-ish from eBay, plug it into your car, and you can type AT commands using a serial console, and your car will talk back to you. Now, that's how easy it is. So to get really basic information, it is dead easy. That's what it does. Once you actually start talking to it, there are a couple of things you need to understand. I won't go into this in huge detail. This is just to give you an overview. There are a number of modes within the OBD interface. Different modes are supported by different manufacturers. And there are certain things you might need to know about one car that you don't care about with another. For example, a diesel car versus a petrol car or an electric car like the ones that are out there. Obviously, there are parameters that apply to a petrol engine that just don't apply to a diesel engine and vice versa. So there are a number of modes. There is a basic mode, which shows some current data and various other things. And there are also extended modes that manufacturers implement that have all sorts of extensions and proprietary stuff that is a real pain to reverse engineer. And additional modes per manufacturer. And within each mode, there is a there are a bunch of parameters, or PIDs. So typically it follows this format. There is the mode, so mode 1, parameter 5. And so what you can do once you get one of these little $30 adapters with your laptop is go to the console and type 0105, enter, and that will send a request for that particular PID to the car, and the car will then send the value back to you. And at this point, you're communicating with the engine management system in the car and getting real-time, or very close to real-time, data from it for basically some free software and a little adapter. So it is quite easy to get started. And this is just some examples of a couple of things. Because the values that come back often need scaling applied to them, or they need a formula applied, you need to understand what each one is, and there's some reference material online. You can buy the standard, but it's typically cryptic and very expensive. So there are a couple of sites around that have compiled this information, and it's now fairly easy to find. So if you look at parameter 5, which is that one I was just mentioning about, this is coolant temperature. So what you do is take the value back, subtract 40 from it, because they can't return negative values and they need to be able to show a negative temperature. So it's got an offset. So if you take the number that it comes back, convert it to decimal, subtract 40, that'll tell you the temperature of the coolant in your car at that point in time. And there are a whole bunch of other things as well. You can see there are formulas for slightly more complicated things, like RPM needs a formula applied to it. But it's really pretty simple. It's just take the numbers back, stitch it into the formula for that particular parameter, and you've got your result. So this stuff really isn't as hard as you might have thought it is. I mean, when you walked into the room, you probably thought, talking to my engine management system in my car is going to be really hard. But it really isn't. Once you, getting this information, as I've just presented it to you in the last 5 minutes, has taken me a lot of research. But when it's all distilled down like this, it's a series of fairly simple steps. And it's really not that hard to reproduce. Vehicle speed you can get. There's a whole bunch of other things. Oh, yeah, and these ones are interesting. If you've got, in a modern car, typically it's got a check engine light. So if something goes wrong and it goes, the check engine light comes on and you know you're meant to take it to your mechanic. But the problem is you don't know how serious the problem is. It could be, oh, my God, the engine's about to explode. Or it could be, on an RX-8, this is a classic known problem, the sensor that detects whether the fuel cap is screwed on properly. And often the sensor fails, which means the fuel cap is screwed on properly, but it comes up with a check engine light because it thinks that the vapor back pressure isn't correct or something. And so you can end up making an expensive trip to a mechanic with a big $10,000 diagnostics console to find out that the petrol cap is not screwed on properly, which is really annoying. But this gets to the point. Don't go to a mechanic and say, oh, yeah, that little warning light, it just came on yesterday, because they'll kind of know, because the engine management system logs it. CEL stands for check engine light, and it records the distance, the travel since the CEL came on, and how long the engine has spent running. So if you've been ignoring it for 2 months and go to your mechanic, they will know about it. There's also one called Clear DTCs, and the TCs are just trouble codes. And inside the engine management system, it keeps a log of trouble codes that it's come up with previously. So the first thing that happens when you take your car to a mechanic is they plug in a diagnostic console or a laptop, and they query to get a list of all the trouble codes. And then they go about fixing whatever the problems might happen to be. The last thing they do before they give the car back to you is they run this command. So basically they call mode 4, and it clears the memory. So it's like wiping the log file. At that point, there is no record left of anything that might have gone wrong previously. And you can do that yourself. I've heard stories of people, before taking their car for compliance testing, they'll pull up around the corner from the testing station and type in 04, clear all the trouble codes, drive into the testing station, they plug in their computer and go, looks good, no trouble codes. So don't do that. So the comment, for those of you who couldn't hear it, is that at the smog testing stations in California, they will know if you've just cleared the trouble codes, and the car needs to be driven for a little while for it to retune itself, essentially. Different engine management systems behave in different ways. With some of them, if you issue this command, it will remove all of its historical tuning parameters. Because what happens is that over time, as a car is driven, it will actually adjust itself to driving styles and things like that. And so the efficiency out of the car with all of that data cleared may not be as good as after you've been driving it for a little while. And vehicle identification number. This is the other thing. The actual control unit contains the ID, which is the chassis ID, essentially. So if you're buying a car, one thing that a lot of people do is take along a laptop computer on one of these dongles and plug it in, and then they query the engine management system to get the VIN. And if it doesn't match what's written on the chassis, then there's something seriously going wrong. It might be a rebirth or something like that, which I don't know whether many of you have heard of, but there is quite an industry in taking cars that have been written off for insurance purposes, transferring identification numbers onto other chassis and things. So you can use the engine management system to catch that sort of thing sometimes. If you've got an older car, so something that's pre-96 and you don't have OBD, typically manufacturers for a few years prior to that had their own interfaces. And this is just an example of a project done by a friend of mine who's over in Perth, who has an older Magna, I think it's an 84 model, which has an interface which has got a serial terminal on it. I think it's just RS232 or something like that. And so he's got this little Arduino-derived design with some firmware that he's written that queries it and gets data back. So if you don't have a car with OBD2, you're not out of luck. You probably can still get data from it. You just may have to do something like this, which is not quite as neat. So when I got my 241 kilometer an hour web server, I wanted to put it online. And so because the boot's really small, so I opened it up, discovered there's this little alcove in the bottom. I've got no idea why they did it, but they must have wanted to increase the cubic feet rating on the data sheet or something. So they put this little alcove in the bottom of the boot, which looked perfect for putting something in and then smoothing the top over so that the boot itself would be flush. And I had some electronics mounted in there. So I made up a little sub-chassis, cut it up out of some wood, stuck it in there, all fitted nicely. And this was my first attempt at having a computer running in my car that I'd put in addition to the factory. And also, something I should point out here is that my objective with this was to have my car online 24/7. There are a lot of people that have put car computers in, like they take a desktop computer or maybe an Atom-based system mounted under the driver's seat and run a special power supply that takes the 12 volts coming off the car's power rail, and then provides like a typical AT-style power connector. The problem is that a computer that's designed for desktop use generally pulls, you know, in the many tens of watts region, and you really just can't leave it running all the time. If you leave it running, your car's going to be flat next time you go out to it. So my objective with this was that I wanted my car to be awake and alive 24/7, even if I wasn't anywhere near it, so that I could log in for remote management purposes and things like that. So that's the reason that I went for the big slab of batteries across the top and various other things. So across there, this was my first attempt. It was 4 sealed lead acid batteries that I nicked out of a UPS. And that was a really bad idea, as I'll get to in just a second. There's also a little charge circuit here, which is designed for charging batteries from a solar cell. So So it takes input from a solar cell, it regulates the current and gives it a nice, well-controlled voltage. And so I used those to recharge the batteries whenever the car was running. There's also a USB port, so I can plug in a whole bunch of stuff that I'll get to in a second. And there's a little computer here called a NET4801 that some of you may have heard of. It's a Socris board designed for use in like in wireless routers and stuff like that. It's reasonably low power, but it still pulled a bit more power than I could get away with. And the batteries were a real problem. Something that I didn't realize at the time, because I didn't know much about battery technology, is sealed lead acid batteries don't like to be discharged. If you take them down below anything more than about 92% charge, which means you can only pull like 8% of charge off the top of them, they're stuffed. They really only like to be discharged very shallowly and then charged back up again. And I killed these batteries in about 3 days. So that wasn't very good. This was the second attempt, and you can see that I've replaced those sealed lead acid batteries with a big single battery, which is also sealed lead acid, but it's a special type called a deep cycle sealed lead acid battery. So it doesn't have such problems. We can pull more charge out of it and then bring it back up to full charge relatively safely. Still not great, and we went on a bit beyond this, but it was an improvement. You can see that the computer, which doesn't have its cover on there, is also a replacement. Instead of a NET4801, I switched to an ALEX1, which is basically, it's a PC architecture. It's like a 233 megahertz machine with flash on it and VGA output and USB and audio and all of that sort of thing. You can plug this into a monitor and a keyboard, and it's a full-on computer, and it pulls about 6 watts total. So that was a really nice thing to do. So I had originally I had Debian running on this, and now I have Ubuntu running on it. And apart from that, the rest is the same. I should say, Yoro gave me that machine. That was very nice of them. I told them I was doing this, and they said, hey, that's cool. We'll give you a computer. And that's the deep cycle battery. So once again, that didn't work because I was still pulling too much power, and I really needed to get it down. So the next thing I did, this is, I'm kind of intermediate stage at the moment. This is a new system based on an Arduino that I put together. What you can see at the very bottom of the stack there, this board here, there's actually 3 PCBs stacked on top of each other. This bottom one is an Arduino Mega, which some of you may have heard of. It's a little embedded microcontroller board, runs at 16 megahertz, has a couple of K of memory, so you certainly know where you're ever going to run Linux on it or something like that. But with some stuff written in C, it does good things. So that's got a couple of boards stacked on top of it. There was a lot of work done since this photo. This was one of the very first photos. You also see on here, this is the guts out of one of the OBD2 interfaces. What I did was bought a commercial OBD2 interface with the USB lead hanging off it, ripped it apart, and I bypassed the USB interface and talked directly to the interface chip. So what I've done here is connected into the a couple of pins on the surface mount chip, and I've got serial comms here going into the Arduino. So with this, I can use, from the Arduino, I can communicate via the serial interface directly to the engine management system. And this whole thing pulls like in the order of a few milliwatts. It's very, very small, very low power. There's also a GPS module here, so I can record GPS data and a whole bunch of other stuff that got added later. So the end result ended up something like this. This is a little box about this big, which I can sit on the seat beside me or stick on the dash or whatever. And it has... What he didn't see on the other internal shot was that I've also used a little module that gives me a USB interface for a memory stick. And the interface takes care of all of the file system stuff, so I don't have to care about it. Once again, it's just a serial interface, but using some serial commands, I can do things like open files on the memory stick, write data into them, all of that sort of thing. The memory stick can then just be unplugged and taken away, plugged into a computer, and you've got a CSV file with all the data in it. So I'm logging a whole bunch of parameters. I think there are about 30-ish parameters I'm recording at the moment, and recording those about 5 times a second and writing them all into the memory stick. So I can pull a lot of data out of that and also do real-time display using the little LCD up there. So you can see the car was running at the time, sitting stationary, obviously. And I think that's coolant temperature, 71 degrees, and 27 degrees would have been external air temperature, which is also being reported by the engine management system. It uses that for mixture calculations and various other things. So this has been the most successful so far, and it takes very, very little power. Right now, my car is in a transitory state. I still have the ALEX1 in the boot, and I have this that I've been playing around with that I plug in. It's not permanently mounted in the car, but the idea is to move towards having this permanently connected. And the other thing that I had connected to the Alex One is a 3G internet connection. The idea is that I'm running a web server in the car itself. This is, comes back to the very first slide. So the actual car itself, if you go to RX8, it's not online right now, though. If you go to rx8.oxford.com.au, there's a web interface, and from there I can log in and control the car remotely and get data out of it and things like that. So even if I'm nowhere near the car, I can still find out what it's doing and start it up and various other things. Oh, I should have mentioned, yeah, I've also modified the ignition system a little bit and got another Arduino mounted inside the dash with some relays connected to it. So from under software control, I can lock and unlock the car, release the boot, start the engine, stop it, that sort of thing. So, and that's all linked through to the web interface as well. So by clicking a couple of buttons, I can start the car from an iPhone or whatever, from anywhere. I was really wanting to be able to do that today from here because that would have meant starting it from 2,500 kilometres away, which is the biggest distance I've done so far, but right now the car's offline, which sucks. So these are the various things that I've got connected to the system at the moment. RFID. I haven't even mentioned that yet. One of the other things I did was plug in, this is why I had this big USB hub in the back, was plug in an RFID reader. So what I did was took an RFID reader and sticky taped the coil into the back right window of the car so that as you walk up to it and approach the driver's door, the reader was right there. And some of you are probably aware that I've got an RFID tag surgically implanted in my arm. So I had it set up so that as I walk up to the car, I could put my arm near the car, the driver's door would unlock, and then the engine starts. So then all I do is open the door, get in, and drive away. So I'll show you some video in a minute of a few other cool things. Audio is also a bit interesting. A lot of people put carputers in because they want to do in-car entertainment. I'm not particularly interested in that, but I wanted to be able to do audio feedback from the onboard computer, have it give me voice warnings when things happen. And these are some of the data points that I'm recording at the moment. This is just a couple of them. There are a lot more than this. So once you actually start recording all of this information, you can start doing interesting things. Like this was a recording of pulling out of my driveway and driving around the block. And that particular one is vehicle speed, intake, air temperature, and throttle position. And the blue line at the bottom that you can see is the vehicle speed. And you can see that it was sitting stationary in my driveway. And just at this point, so the green one is throttle position. And at this point, the car had been sitting idling in my driveway for about 2 hours because I'd been working on the system. So the intake temperature was quite hot under the bonnet. And you can see here I blipped the throttle while the car was out of gear. And then I put it into reverse, blipped the throttle again, and the car starts moving. So I got up to about 4 kilometres an hour backwards out of my driveway, out into the street, stop. And then you can see accelerating up the street again, coming up here. And that, you know, the throttle position goes up and the vehicle speed follows. So then driving around some streets and things. Then there are a couple of interesting things you can see here. You can see that the ambient air temperature under the bonnet decreases. This is the air intake temperature as the car starts rolling because it's getting better airflow, obviously. One of the interesting things here is that when I came to a stop at an intersection, so I was slowing down here and came to a complete stop for a little while, the air temperature, you can see, rises quite rapidly. So it's kind of interesting. I'm a geek, so I love data. But I just love poking around in this sort of thing and seeing what I can derive from it. And there are all sorts of unexpected things that come out of this when you start examining this data. So this is another example. Now, we're only showing two parameters here. There's vehicle speed and fuel level. Blue one is vehicle speed. So I was driving down the street and obviously came to a set of lights, stop. Set of lights, stop. And the fuel level, which is the green one, is squiggling around here as I'm moving around. And along here, there is this massive spike right here in fuel level. So obviously I wasn't refueling the car while I was driving along, but something's going on here. And this is just sort of a demonstration. What I'm getting here is the raw data coming back out of the engine management system. So this is not what the fuel gauge is showing. And this just demonstrated to me that obviously the fuel gauge has a massive damping factor in it because it's not bouncing around as you drive along. But this is what the engine management system is seeing. So we'll look at some more data. That's right. I was also, we'll go back to that previous one. I was thinking about this. I was just sitting there looking at this data. I generated these graphs. And I saw vehicle speed had been set to zero for here for ages. and I was thinking, okay, I'm logging vehicle data, so I can see where it comes to a stop and comes to a halt, because we've obviously stopped the traffic lights here. I also have GPS data. So just hypothesizing, if I examined the speed data off my car, cross-referenced it to GPS, I could probably automatically find all of the intersections that I've ever stopped at. And so I did that with a little script and got to and threw the result into Google Maps, and that was what came out. So I was actually sitting at that intersection at Canterbury on Canterbury Road at that particular point in the data. So interesting correlations that come out of it. Another interesting correlation, if you look at this stuff, was fuel level change here. So the other thing you can find is every petrol station you've ever been to. Because all you have to do is crunch the data and you can see, okay, the car was stationary, the fuel level increased, therefore it must have been a petrol station. So once again, I ran a script across all the data trying to find all the possible locations at which there might have been a petrol station, fed them into Google Maps, and that was what came out. It was a petrol station. That's where I happened to be. And so that was pretty cool. So I can generate plots of petrol stations. And the other thing is, there's some other strange stuff about this graph. There are some very large jolts in the fuel level there, and if you look next door to what's at that petrol station, you'll figure out why. I think Google Maps is even... Oh, no, it's not. I thought there was a symbol there showing what it was. So if you look at these little jolts here, they correspond, and there's a jolt there on the fuel level, that corresponds to that that speed bump, which is on the exit of the McDonald's drive-thru, that I happened to go through immediately after filling up with petrol. So I just think it's really cool that you can take engine management data, and then once you start playing with it, you can extract all of this information, like the fact that, hey, you went there, filled up with petrol, and then went to that McDonald's. So, what can we demo? I'll come back to some videos towards the end. The audio system that I was mentioning before. As I showed you earlier, the audio system in an RX-8 is very tightly integrated into everything else. And so you can't really just rip it out and put a new head unit in. It's got all sorts of information displayed on the actual sound system, and it's also a really awkward shape, so you can't fit a standard radio in there. And I wanted to be able to get audio into the sound system from the computer in the boot. And so what I had to do was pull apart the head unit, which has got no auxiliary input, which was a real pain. I wanted to be able to find an auxiliary input, switch to auxiliary on my head unit, and then just have audio from the sound system play through. Didn't work at all. So what I did was open up the head unit, and I found the output from the audio preamplifier that comes out of the CD player, and wired a couple of inputs into it in parallel. So what you see there are a couple of black wires that are soldered onto the audio board, and by injecting an audio signal in at that point, the head unit thinks that you're playing a CD, or the audio is playing from the CD, and it just comes through the sound system, which is cool. So I had a cable going from there back into the boot. But there was a problem with that. The problem is that the sound system is smart enough to know if you have a CD in the CD player and whether it's playing, and it mutes if there is no CD player playing. And that was really, really annoying. So that was a hardware problem that I decided to fix with some Perl. So with this little script, I generated a WAV file of silence that was about 60 minutes long and burned it to an audio CD. Chucked the audio CD in, put it on continuous play. Problem solved. So, yeah, I like fixing hardware problems with software and software problems with hardware. Oh, yeah, RFID, we've already talked about that. So that was just the icky photo. So down the bottom, you can see the implantable tag. That's an injector partway down. The same sort of stuff is used in cats and dogs and things like that, normally injected into the back of the neck. I didn't want it back there because it's not too convenient. So I've stuck it in my arm instead. The other thing is cameras, reversing cameras. A lot of cars have got reversing cameras on them now. And I was reversing, this was quite a while ago now, it was about a year ago, thinking, well, a camera on the back is kind of useful because it's looking back in the direction that you're traveling. But it would still be so much more useful if you weren't stuck on the perspective of the car itself. What happens if you take a reversing camera and take it totally away from the car, put it somewhere else? And because the car has both Wi-Fi and a 3G internet connection, I can do things like stream video from my home automation system into the car, which means I could stick a video camera somewhere else, and then from inside the car you get a God's eye view of what you're looking at, of the car. So if I can figure out how to drive Andy's laptop and get to the right screen, I'll show you the result of what this sort of thing can look like. How do I reload on this? Command R? That'll do. Okay, so this is a couple of videos. One video camera stuck up on under the eaves of the house, looking down into the driveway. And as you can see, my driveway has a big blind spot. If someone walks down the path right here, I could hit them. This is out near my front gate, looking down the front. So the idea is that instead of having a reversing camera that just shows you the view from the car, which you can see anyway, you can have a reversing camera that shows you the view from outside the car, which is kind of spooky when you're actually driving and you get that third-person perspective. It's really weird. But really cool, really handy. Actually made me think what I really need is a little spy drone that flies above my car, maybe about 100 meters up. I'll work on that one for next year. I want live downlink. So I'll see if I can find a couple of other interesting videos. What else do we have here? Yeah, unfortunately, as I said, I can't demo the car. That's the wrong one. I can't demo the car live right now, but I can show you a couple of other things. Oh, we have Google Earth here. That's cool. Yeah, so the data that comes out of the memory stick obviously has all the GPS values. So I've got lat, long, altitude, and other stuff you get out of GPS like speed, timestamp and things. I've also got all the engine management information. So I've got vehicle speed, coolant temperature, RPM, blah, blah, blah. So what I did was write a little script that takes that data and converts it into a format called KML, which is for Google Earth. And it's basically just XML. So what this allows you to do is feed data from the car into Google Earth and then generate a 3D fly around. So this is data that was pulled out of the car showing me driving out of my driveway. So my house is right about there. And you can see that the car was going quite slowly at the time. Yeah. How do I zoom in on this? I don't know. There. So, oh, okay, up here. No, it's not there. Oh, well. But anyway, I thought that was pretty cool. So I can take data out of the car, and you can see that as I was driving around, the vehicle speed was varying. So what I did in this particular case was took the data, the GPS data for the position, and then set the height of the line to be based on the speed of the car at that point in time. So as I came up to this corner, for example, at this intersection, you can see the line drops. So the car was going more slowly and then decelerated here coming down to this intersection. And then here where I was driving around and ended up driving into a dead-end street and turning around again. But yeah, I thought that was really cool. So this was done. Once again, it's a matter of once you've got the data, you just got to start thinking about ways you can use it. It was all sitting there, and one day I just suddenly thought, hey, I could plot this, and that would look cool. So a bit of scripting later, and that's what we ended up with. So I'll show you a video that was recorded earlier in the year, which demonstrates some of the stuff the car does. Kind of cheesy, but
hi, I'm Jonathan.
I can't actually demonstrate it, so we'll have to do it this way.
We're going to have a quick look at a couple of the modifications I've made to my RX-8.
Can we have volume up a little bit, if that's possible?
Inside the boot, you'll see an ALX 1, which is a little computer which only draws about 6 watts. It's very low power. It's also connected to a number of systems within the car. For example, this is the OBD interface, which is the onboard diagnostic system. That's typically where a mechanic would plug in their laptop to see what's going on with the car if something goes wrong. That's underneath the dash. There is also a high-gain antenna for a 3G mobile internet connection, and there is a modem for that as well, and a connection to a custom ignition controller, which goes down underneath the dash. That's what lets me start and stop the car by remote control, lock it, unlock it, that sort of thing. And you'll also notice a charge circuit. This keeps the battery topped up whenever the car is running, it is recharging this large battery over here, which is a deep cycle sealed lead acid battery. That's what keeps the computer running even when the car is stopped. Because the system has a web interface, I can access the functions of my car from any device that can run a web browser. So it could be a laptop computer, a desktop computer, or even an iPhone or an iPod. I've loaded up the web interface on this iPod Touch so that I can do things like lock and unlock the car just from here. Now, because I am connecting via the internet, not directly to the car, there can be a slight delay, but it gives me a lot of control. For example, what I can do is click one button there to start the engine, and I can also stop the engine. Now, the next screen on this little application is a telemetry interface, which shows me data coming back from the engine management system. From here, I can see how fast the engine is revving, the battery voltage, how much fuel is left in it, the timing, and a whole lot of other parameters related to the engine. The next interface is a Google Maps screen, which shows the current location of the car using GPS data, which is coming from the car itself. So at any point in time, with any device that can access the internet, I can see the location of the car, control it remotely, and get access to engine management data. Thanks for watching, and if you would like some more information, go along to our website, geekmyride.org.
Yeah, so I was really hoping to be able to demonstrate the web interface here, but it's offline, so I can't do that. I'll have to get home and do some debugging. So, thank you very much for watching, and if anyone has ideas about other stuff they could either do with the data or other things that could be controlled or fun you could have within a car, please come and talk to me. Thank you. Are there any questions, by the way? I saw a hand half go up. No? Yes.
I was just wondering about ways of, you know, since you've got all this information, you could find ways of using the engine more efficiently, using less fuel. Is there any way of sort of having a control system that can somehow economize the fuel consumption?
Mm-hmm. The biggest impact that you can possibly have using this sort of system is to change your own driving habits. And there is a very active project called MPGuino and a spin-off project called, which is obviously based on miles per gallon, and another one called OBDuino, which is actually what I based my code base on for the latest version of the system. And the whole objective of that is to provide immediate feedback on fuel consumption to the driver. And there is a forum called EconoModders, I think it is, EconoModders.com, where it's developed. And there are a whole bunch of very obsessive people who have competitions to see how far they can go with the minimum fuel usage, and people that will fabricate new aerodynamic fittings for their cars to try to decrease drag and things like that. And so the actual system that I had that I showed sitting up on my dash is pretty much the same configuration as those people would use, but what they do is they have a big current fuel consumption, like instantaneous fuel consumption figure up there. And then once you start seeing that information come back to you, it just makes you accelerate more slowly and that sort of thing. And there are a lot of functions in that code that allow you to do things like log fuel consumption per trip. And and what a lot of people do who start using the system is they do things like turn their car off at the lights. And in fact, there is a function built into the code that will report how much fuel you've wasted while sitting still. So you get to the end of the trip and it says, you have used 2.2 litres of petrol while stationary, you know, that sort of thing. So a lot of this sort of stuff can definitely be used for that. In terms of tuning the car and improving its efficiency, in order to do that, you would need to modify the way the engine itself runs. And that's beyond what you could do without more invasive procedures. That sort of thing can be done, but manufacturers obviously try to prevent you hacking around with the way it runs the timing and the injectors and stuff like that. Let's go to Skyline. Oh, there's certain cars that you can do heaps of stuff with. Actually, there's a friend of mine in Melbourne who started a company called Wolf. They make Wolf 3D, et cetera, engine management systems. And what he's doing now is working with performance motorbikes. He's got a thing called Bike Interceptor that is a tiny little box what happens is that on a performance bike, you unplug the line from the engine management system to your fuel injectors, and you plug it into his box, and the other side of the box plugs into the injectors, and it fakes the signal to the injectors, and it pretends to the engine management system that it is fuel injectors. And so you can do things like to either improve efficiency or improve performance. And in fact, his system was running on the super stock bike that won the Grand Prix at Phillip Island about 2 months ago, or something like that. So, there is certainly scope for that sort of thing, but it's beyond the realm of plugging into OBD and pulling some data out. Is there another question? Yes. Oh, down here.
You mentioned something about the stock computer getting used to your driving style.
Mm.
Would having multiple drivers start upsetting this balance, or does it have some sort of profile set up?
Yeah, well, I should say it's probably not so much driving style. It's more the variation in the individual car. I mean, cars all come off the same production line, but there is always variation in the strength of spark and various other things about the engine itself. And so they tend to tune themselves a little bit over time, more suited to the car than to the driver, I suppose. Yeah.
Would it in theory be possible to use the data that you've got to drive the car without actually being in the car?
Possibly. There's obviously, that was one of the very first things I thought of. I wanted to reproduce the whole James Bond thing of lying in the back seat with the phone and driving the car. And actually, it's not so far-fetched. I mentioned earlier that there is a whole lot of fly-by-wire system in an RX-8. One of them is the electrically assisted power steering. And it measures the torque that you're applying to the steering wheel, and then it helps you. So I was figuring that if I could intercept the data coming from the steering angle sensors and the torque sensors, I could fool it into thinking I was trying to turn the steering wheel, and it would then help me with the power steering. So I should be able to actually steer the car. Of course, my car's a manual, so that's all a moot point. But if you had an auto and you could control the transmission, then potentially, yeah. Absolutely. And you've only got to look at all the stuff that has to be done for the DARPA challenge to realize that the job that a person does driving a car is actually remarkably hard to replace with electronics and software. It's a very, very hard job. It's really cool watching them, actually. Every year they get so much better. And there is a huge amount of work being done at the moment in terms of self-driving cars. And obviously self-driving cars have been around for a long time in research facilities, in very controlled environments. The issue is when you take something like that and throw it out into the big wide world with other cars doing unpredictable things. If we were starting the transport system from scratch and all cars could be autonomous and they all talk to each other and they could cooperate, it'd be fine. But the problem is that you put an automatic car out in the street with human drivers around it and stuff is just going to go wrong. So they are making massive strides towards it. Oh, and also something else I should point out is that there is work being done in the mining industry. A lot of stuff, as I was mentioning, the roads being an uncontrolled environment. In controlled environments, there is a huge amount of work that's been done and progress that's been made. Forklifts that drive themselves, even mining trucks like the big 787Bs or whatever they are, which at 600 tons fully loaded, they'll drive around at 30, 40 kilometres an hour, totally autonomous, isn't even a human in them. They're just being driven by a computer and it's this thing that's like five stories high. Pretty scary.
Is anybody interested in working on the engine management system, sort of fuel injection side of things? There's an open source project called SuperSquirt, which is always looking for people to come in and hack about with their. It's a hardware thing, and it's really great because a lot of that sort of tuning stuff is actually so closed down, and most of the manufacturers, even Nissan, who basically allow people to screw with their stuff, and the Skylines are not very happy about it. But SuperSquirt, yeah.
So where do you find that? Is it just supersquirt.com?
SuperSquirt.org online.
.org. Cool.
Just put it SuperSquirt into Google, it'll find it.
Sounds interesting. Yeah, any more questions? Yes. Yeah.
I'm amazed that the OBD onboard diagnostics connector is documented and is open to the point where you can actually read all these parameters, and I didn't know that. I thought it was a sort of dark, closed secret. Is it documented? I'm sorry I missed the first few minutes.
Yeah, the short answer is yes, it's documented, but the documentation is a pain in the butt to find. I think it's an ISO standard, and you can go off and spend your X $100 and buy the standard, which won't necessarily help you understand it. And there are a couple of different layers to it. There is the electrical interface itself, so how you connect into the car, and then there are the protocols that sit on top of it and the parameters and things. So what the standard defines is the groups of parameters which are common to all manufacturers, and then there are manufacturer extensions. And unfortunately, this is one of these situations where you might have a defined standard at the bottom layer. Okay, classic example. Microsoft's DocX format. Okay, so they say, it's XML, it's open, and then they stick a big binary blob in the middle. The same sort of thing is done by car manufacturers. They will say, okay, we're going to talk over CAN bus, but all of our messaging is encrypted and proprietary and you can't touch it. So you'll be able to get the basic information out of it, the common stuff, but a typical, like there might be 600 PIDs in a modern car, and there are only 30 of them that you can get access to. And that's just unfortunately the way they've done it.
What's the most open manufacturer?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Are there any better than
I haven't found any in particular.
I don't know about any better. Nissan basically got forced into it because there was a whole team of sort of like wet behind the ears teenage hackers who managed to figure out a way to get into the computer on. And so that's why you see so many Skylines and doing drifts, because they're just really, really easy to tune. Probably the worst in a lot of them is Mercedes-Benz. I own Mercedes-Benz. But the new ML series diesels on the Mercedes-Benz, the engine will not work outside the chassis it was put in, because the computer system is everything. It's so integrated within the system, we can't get them to run. Yeah, they've got electronic common rail diesels, and it's just almost impossible.
Great. Well, if there are no more questions, if anybody wants to talk to me directly, cool, come and talk to me. Otherwise, thank you very much.